Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use and cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Ashley. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I do believe this is the first. You and I have known each other virtually, I guess we might say, for a couple of years. We've had a couple of conversations, but I think this is the first time we've had you on the podcast. Before we dive into our conversation, how about we let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to be able to put a face with the name, like you said, after many years of speaking.
Likewise.
My name's Ashley Lambert. I am from the St. Louis metropolitan area, so on the Illinois side. I have been in fundraising now for 9 years. Before getting into fundraising, though, I did direct care in foster care, case manager. And so I've been able to live the mission before I went into fundraising and spreading the awareness of the mission. And I think that'll be relevant to our conversation today. Like I said, I've been at the same nonprofit for 9 years. Again, that's a little different. So a bit of a unicorn when it comes to the field of fundraising, where people usually switch to different agencies back and forth. Besides that, I have a little boy named Jake. And like I said, live in the Midwest.
Ashley, you're probably the first person we're broadcasting probably episode, this is probably number 220 or something. I think you're the first person on the that has used the word direct care. And I'll tell you, I'll get your thoughts on this one. So when my wife and I, right after we got married, we went to work for a children's home. And that was the term that they referred to us as employees. We were direct care employees. And I had that same experience. And you and I, when we first met, might have talked about this. But it was that time that we worked in the program with the children that I think actually better prepared me for the work that I was doing. It gave me a layer of context that I didn't have, would not have otherwise. What's your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. It definitely gives me a different type of motivation in supporting the mission, but it also gives me the ability to speak from the heart when connecting with stakeholders.
Yeah.
Whenever you've been able to see those children firsthand or move them from homes and can feel that vicarious trauma that you go through as being a direct care provider,
yeah,
you can tell the story a lot differently to stakeholders.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. So the employee, so I transitioned. I was only in direct care with my wife for about a year. And the executive director figured out that I'd be a better fundraiser. I didn't even know what fundraising was at the time. And I quickly figured it out, but I was better suited for it. That's what he figured out. And that's what I figured out, because I wasn't very good with the kids. I was like a big brother who was always getting in trouble with them, either having too much fun or not getting along with them, like a stubborn big brother or something. My wife, however, was remarkably good at it. And she continued to do that until she had our first child, Gordon, who is now 18 years old. So I've been watching you and your husband. You and I are connected on Facebook. You're on the other end of raising children. You're on the very front end. We've had our oldest is now in his first year of college, and the other three are very closely behind. So I appreciate living vicariously through my friends like yourself who are all raising little ones. So congratulations. You and I haven't talked since the little guy came along. So congratulations. Ashley, we agreed we were going to talk about a big idea or bold opinion today. What do you got for us?
One of the things that I'm really passionate about is a culture of philanthropy and really looking at it through the lens of it not being a strategic goal objective, and for it to be built more authentically. What I mean by culture of philanthropy is just an organizational values or the way that kind of business is supporting development and fundraising. And I think that if you build that through building relationships, just relationship building, it's going to be more successful. And I think what I mean by that is when I mentioned that I did direct care is that fundraisers and leadership needs to sit alongside of the direct care staff and hear their stories, hear what their needs are. What are the obstacles of their clients, the people that you serve, and go from there and let the, for my situation, you know, case foster care case managers lead the way in fundraising. And then you're going to be able to more organically tell those stories to your stakeholders, your high impact donors, and get a better buy-in when all of these things, it's more friend raising and relationship building.
Am I sort of hearing, so you know this, you've read my book, I'm sort of a critic. Everybody knows this. I'm not really big into this notion of fundraising sort of being driven by PR and marketing and sort of advertising, very, very sort of manufactured, if you will. And what I think I'm hearing, Ashley, which I think we're on the same page here, is this idea that if it's sort of rooted programmatically, which means it emerges directly from the program itself, that perhaps fundraising will actually do better. I mean, that's certainly been my experience. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, I agree. Exactly. I think it needs to be rooted into the programs and not an objective that a consultant company gave you to go in and tell your staff, this is what fundraisers do.
Right.
You know,
right.
We have advertisements, then we have a golf tournament, and then we have this, and then this is how you're going to be able to help us accomplish those things.
Right. Right.
It very much so needs to be the direct care staff telling you, you know, this is the need, this is the obstacle, or this is what our contract's not providing for our clients. And then as fundraisers, we can go out and learn the community leaders and what type of philanthropic goals they want to make. Yeah. And then you connect those two together. And I think that makes for a longer lasting culture of philanthropy within the organization, but also externally with your supporters. Because if those things can match together more so than being this big PR splash or this big golf tournament, you're going to see more significant gifts. And then you're going to see a happier staff because you're going to give them the things that they need and not something that's just kind of forced upon them.
So did it take you doing the work? You've been in the work almost 10 years. And one of the things I oftentimes point out about the folks that I was writing that first book to is that I was largely talking to that individual who's been about a decade in and was starting to think a little more critically than the seminars and workshops that they can get at, say, an AFP conference, sort of beyond those 101 how fundraising works sort of you know, you were thinking more critically about the work that you did, and you're obviously at that place. But at what point in your fundraising career, in that sort of that 10-year trajectory, did you get to that place where you were thinking like what you're describing? Like, when did you figure all this out? When did you realize that the golf tournament just wasn't cutting it?
I think it was about halfway in, when we were kind of on a rat wheel of fundraising events, you know, golf tournaments, yes, and trivia nights, and for lack of better terms, you know, the bake sales and the lemonade stands, and yes, all of these things where you're just kind of piecemealing together your budget. And, you know, it dawned on me, if we have, even if you just have a handful of, you know, individuals that can make significant or meaningful gifts, if you can connect them with the story of your mission directly, and then give them the impact story after they've made that gift and continue that relationship, it's going to be much more fruitful for everybody involved. And you don't have to spend all that staff time. Not to say that there's not a place for those events, because they do, you know, help raise some awareness, and they might do some prospecting for you, bring some new people in.
Yeah.
But I think the main majority of it needs to lie with just relationship building. Completely. I mean, that's the bottom line, I think, of fundraising. And so, yeah, I figured that out about 5 years in. And luckily, the organization that I work for was very much so invested in that idea as well.
Yeah.
Because even though the organization I work for has been around since 1947, we're new to fundraising and the fact that we separated from a Catholic diocese about 10 years as well. So we just now were able to do our own fundraising. So at first, it really was just, you know, golf tournaments and the trivia nights. But now we switched to individual giving. And it, like I said, going back to direct care staff, it makes them happier, too, because it gives, we allow them to have a direct pipeline to those stakeholders. They help us tell the story, and they help us give the impact reports, and they help us do the tours for those people.
So was the going that point there? I've never heard. I've certainly heard that, but I've never heard it with that much specificity, I don't think. So the diocese was allowing you to do the galas and the golf tournaments. One of my critiques on the way that a lot of fundraising gets designed for a lot of organizations is it is designed for the sake of maintaining control and not in order to grow relationships. And it sounds like that's a key example of sort of, it's a very anecdotal sort of example of where control was sort of the aspiration, where that was sort of the underlying motive. We have to sort of control the process. And then perhaps they got to the place where they sort of relinquished control and they said more opportunities are there. And like you're pointing out, we can't get to those meaningful gifts. We can't get to those meaningful relationships if we don't relinquish control. Is that sort of what was happening? Is that sort of the untold story that was playing out between your organization and the diocese?
I believe so when it comes to a lot of different aspects of when we were with the diocese, but fundraising was definitely that way. We were under control. We were only allowed to do so much fundraising, yeah, and it definitely much so was just that arm's length stuff, you know, raffles, fundraisers, that kind of, yeah, in-person stuff,
yeah,
because the diocese wanted to do the other things. And so it did. It dampered, for the topic of this, of today's conversation, of the culture of philanthropy. They weren't really allowing us to build that culture internally with our staff or externally with community members. And so when we separated from them and became an independent nonprofit, we were able to really take that and run with it. And it's been very beneficial. We have seen fundraising dollars go up. We've seen in all aspects. So even when we do still have the, you know, the galas or the golf tournaments, as well as grants have went up, and definitely individual giving has increased, as well as just participation from all levels of supporters and all levels of staff.
So, and I think that's sometimes some of the things that people miss when we start talking about more meaningful engagement with donors. You haven't completely unplugged galas and golf tournaments. That sort of new acquisition strategy, the way in which you actually go about securing the new donor is still there. It's just, it's in its proper place. I mean, is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. Yes. We still have those type of events. We actually have a virtual gala in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Sure. So we still have those things.
Yeah.
Because it is a way of getting new people involved that may not have known about your organization beforehand. But it's also, for us, it's a way to acknowledge maybe the interests or desires of some of the higher impact stakeholders that we have, people making significant, meaningful gifts, because as you build authentic relationships, you do learn that some people do desire to have their name on a gala.
Yes.
Or some corporations, right. Foundations, sure. Do desire that type of thing. And so I think there's a place for it in all lanes of fundraising, yeah. A gala. It just should not be the only thing that a development department is accomplishing to meet their budget.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you find that you're flourishing more in sort of this new, it is part of the reason that you're advocating for this more to sort of this bottom up grassroots sort of understanding of how to create a culture of philanthropy? Do you find that you're flourishing more and being able to sort of one author that I've been reading talks about how we set employees up to shine, and I think in the very mechanical, heavy gala golf tournament, new acquisition sort of context, a lot of our development officers are not given the opportunity to shine. And even if you go back to the beginning of our conversation, if you think about what we were talking about with sort of touching the organization, being able to, like in the case with my wife and I, when we were at the children's home, you know, knowing that you could engage with the organization, it was rooted sort of in the program. You can flourish. I mean, you can actually, you can sort of touch it. Are you following what I'm saying?
I think so. Yeah. And I think that is one of the things that set me up for success at my current organization. And honestly, the only place that I've done fundraising professionally outside of volunteer work,
sure.
is that I have had that, intimate connection to the mission. And I think that's a very, vital piece of the puzzle, is to have a fundraiser that's passionate about the mission. Like, you have to love that mission. Like, don't go work in higher education if that's not where your passion lies.
Yeah.
And then to have that organization give the fundraiser the opportunity to experience and immerse themselves in the programming. And so a way that my organization does that is whenever we hire a new person in development, we have them shadow programs. So obviously it's not going to be as in depth as mine was of doing 3 years of direct care and foster care. But at least they're going to go and see and speak to the clients and see the facilities. And I think that gives them a better foundation to speak to stakeholders and to tell the story and to succeed in their role.
I don't know if I picked up on that detail. So mm-hmm. you spent 3 years in direct care. I couldn't, like, when I was telling you the story of my time at the children's home, I lasted about 9 months. you have to be able to tell better stories, and you're probably better at discerning or sort of picking up on the specifics in those stories. Cause we love to, in fundraising, talk about storytelling, but I don't know mm-hmm. if enough of us have actually experienced what is sort of the storytelling content in our organizations enough to actually be able to tell real genuine stories. I'm guessing you've probably got some of the best stories that you could tell because you literally did the work for 3 years. You interacted with these presumably children and parents and fans, you know, there's got to be much more. I guess what I'm saying is there has to be much more layering to your ability to tell stories having done that 3 years. I'd almost say every fundraiser should get the advantage of those 3 years. You follow me?
I agree. I mean,
that's like major. It's like grad school. It's like grad school for fundraising in like reverse, right?
So it's like
do 4 years of fundraising, but then actually go back and actually immerse yourself in the program, and you might find that it's actually the non fundraising sort of training that actually makes you better at what you're doing.
I completely agree with that. So a little bit more. So I do have a master's in public administration and policy analysis. So I knew I wanted to be a nonprofit leadership, specifically in the fundraising side. At the time of grad school, I was looking at grant writing as what I really thought I wanted to do. But then I got out of school and couldn't get a job because everyone had 5 to 10 years of experience before you could get a job and didn't count internships. And so I became a foster care case manager. And I think that at the time I looked at it as a setback. But now it was actually the thing that allows me to be successful and it allows me to, make a bigger impact when it comes to fundraising than I would have, if I would have got a job right out of grad school. Because you're right. I'm able to now tell the stories firsthand. And so I know that's a little bit unique of a fundraiser. Not a lot of fundraisers, like you said, make it 3 years in direct care. You might make it about, 6 months to a year.
Yeah.
Because it's hard work. I thank our foster care case managers all the time for the hard work that they do, because not a lot of people can do it. But I think the other way that you can kind of combat that with a traditional fundraiser that does not have that experience is you have them meet with your direct care. So if it's foster care in my instance, or if you're, working for an assisted living program or, any of those things, you have your fundraisers go and meet with them, sit in on their staff meetings, learn about their struggles, hear about when they go to their supervisor and they have an obstacle with a client and they don't know how to solve it. And your current contract isn't going to pay for it. So here, how did they solve that problem directly? And then how can you come in and help? Because I think by hearing those stories and trying to absorb it as much as possible, you can tell the narrative to a funder or to an individual. But you also that lights a fire in the fundraiser to want to make a difference and in the way that they can. And I think both of those things are needed for success. You need the passion and you need the intimate knowledge of your program.
Yeah. Okay. So does it make you better? One of the things that I've said oftentimes in my seminar, one of the things I oftentimes say is that the fundraiser is sort of a bridge builder. So you're the person that sort of knows how to connect the story. So there's the story on the sort of the programmatic side. There's the mission of the organization. And there's those that are sort of, there's the donor who's perhaps giving money or time or volunteering expertise or whatever they're sort of volunteering or contributing. Are you better at sort of building those bridges because you've done that? I'm really trying to make the case. I'm trying to make the case for that 3-year graduate program.
Yeah.
Are you better at building those bridges because you've done that direct care work?
Yeah, I would think so. Cause, in a way it builds more credibility.
Yes. Right.
Good
word.
When I'm sitting with somebody, and I can tell them, in a residential program, we need X, Y, Z. And then they might kind of shrug off, well, why would you need that? Or, the state pays for that. You have a contract. And then I can back up and say, I've spent time with these children. I've done the work. I've heard their stories and I could share a story with them. And then I think then they're more likely to come alongside of me when they know that I've done it. It's kind of the same as when you have a client or a direct service staff come with you to a meeting or speak at your annual gala. You're doing that to build credibility of your story because of its firsthand knowledge. My unique situation of that 3 years, I'm able to just do that myself.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Totally.
Because we all know, like, if a funder or an individual hears the story from a client or somebody that's doing the work, they're more likely to say, yeah, that makes sense, and help fund that idea. But I'm able to kind of sometimes cut that out, especially in a situation where a lot of times we can't do that for the privacy of those that we serve. We can't bring them along. They're youth.
Yeah.
And we need to protect them.
Yeah. So when my wife and I were at that children's home, this was 20 years ago, and we could, in the state of Virginia, and perhaps, I don't know if the laws were different or if it was just 20 years ago or we just didn't know any better, but we'd put these kids in these vans and we'd take them to these supporting churches, for example. And it was my wife still working in the program while Erica was still working in the program. It allowed me, and oftentimes she did really well with the older boys. And so I would, when I was visiting these churches, sometimes independently, I'd put two or three of them in the back seat of the van or whatever I was driving. And I'd take them on these road trips and we'd go do these presentations and stuff. And it kept me rooted. So even when I transitioned into fundraising, which is where I truly shined, it allowed me to sort of stay rooted. But not only did it allow me to stay connected with the youngsters, the kids in the program, but what it also allowed me to do is, and this gets back to the notion of creating sort of this culture of philanthropy, sort of what culture truly is. When you're relating to those staff who are in direct care now, they have to know that you're sincere, that you're authentic, that you really get it. That's what I figured out, I don't know, 5 years, you know, 4 or 5 years into the job. I was sitting there talking to some of our house parents at the children's home, and one of them said something to me that they appreciated that I had actually worked in the program before. And understand, I had only worked in the program successfully for 9 months and wasn't very good at it, but they were still giving me, quote unquote, credit. If you know, they still said you went to graduate school. I have to imagine that's part of what sort of scores you points is you're trying to build this culture of philanthropy, is that the staff, the program staff, actually look at you, Ashley, and say, she knows what we're doing. Am I right?
Yes, I agree that it does give me kind of a little bit of an in right off the bat whenever I sit down and talk to it, because since my organization, we cover about southern half of the state of Illinois, we have about 450 employees, and so as I meet them, I have to constantly kind of reintroduce myself because there's new staff members, and so I let them know what I do now, but then I let them know my history with the organization, and you can kind of almost see the weight go off of their shoulders and like a sigh of like, oh, this person understands, you know, what we're kind of going through. And another reason why we're successful in that is that our CEO actually has done the same. He's our CEO of our organization, but he started out as a counselor, at the same organization. Yeah. And so whenever he goes out and speaks with our staff, he will remind them of that at times. And again, you can see kind of this sigh of our leadership and the people that are representing us in the community have done the same work. And they understand some of the struggles that it goes to complete the work when it comes to just emotional trauma that our clients our staff go through, but also just the bureaucracy of how do you accomplish things within a state contract without additional funds. So we understand that part. So we're able to just tell that story. And like you said, be a catalyst a connecting piece to the community to get those things for them.
Okay. So go a little theoretical with me. I've been studying up on this. I'm working on this new book and I've been studying up on this concept of serendipity, and I have to, and somehow or another, I've got to connect it in the book with this notion of sort of this cultural emergence concept of sort of it coming from the bottom up, which is, I'm trying to make the same case you are here on the podcast today. Do you find that your sort of rootedness in the program and those 3 years that you spent in the program actually makes you, that you can actually discern opportunities better? Like you can actually see a donor, you can interact with a donor and better discern that this person actually cares and understands what's going on and actually will yield perhaps a more meaningful relationship and more meaningful gift. Are you following me? So let's say you got donor A and donor B, right? You're at the golf tournament. And because you actually know the story, and perhaps you now know a little bit of their story, donor A's story and donor B's story, can you better discern which one's actually going to go somewhere versus one that's not? Because you can actually start to sort of put the pieces together in your head. Are you following me? Sort of an intuitive, I'm thinking that the intuitiveness that we sometimes talk about fundraisers having, I'm wondering if some of that intuition comes from having touched the program in ways that you have differently than somebody who's just spent their time just in fundraising.
Yeah, I think that argument or that point of view is very valid because there are times. So as a major gifts fundraiser, you know, I have my list of prospects that I'm supposed to, you know, to work with. And as I interact with them, I can discern which one would probably more likely to give a meaningful or significant gift outside of what their wealth screening says. So once you get to know them a little bit, you can say, okay, this is why this person is passionate, or maybe this person's not completely empathetic. They're doing it for other reasons. And it might be a one-time kind of arm's length gift of let's move this person along. I'm on to the next, you know, nonprofit to give a donation to it and see kind of how my ego can be stripped. And then what person's staying there because they have an emotional connection to the organization. And then when you really build that relationship with them, show them how they can make an impact and you build upon their passion and desires, it's going to be more fruitful. And I do think that sometimes my connection to the programs gives me that vantage point. You get to see the person's personality and what really would connect them to the program. And then you can speak from the heart on that.
See, right. That's it. You're not trying to connect them to a marketing gimmick, right? I mean, I get it. You need a 12-page, 14-page case for support, and it's beautiful and it's flashy, but you're not trying to connect a living human being. What you're able to do, because you've worked on both sides of this exchange, you're able to connect human to human, not human to marketing plan, I guess you could say. And it's the same offense. I had a guest on here on the podcast, I don't know, 9 months ago. It's the same sort of offensive sort of posture that we sometimes take when we put the, what she was critiquing. This was a woman in the United Kingdom, and she was saying that we need to stop. She was basically talking about how we exploit these, in your case, in the foster care program. We take these youngsters, we take their stories, we take their photographs, we put them on flashy brochures, and we raise money with it. And there's not real substance to it. You know, it becomes sort of a marketing tactic, and it raises money and it works, but is the beneficiary actually speaking for themselves? And then likewise, you can sort of flip the coin on the other side and you see the benefactor not being able to speak for themselves. But what you're able to do is you're able to connect these real human stories with other real human stories. I remember at the children's home, one of our most significant donors that I worked with, I can't recall his name. I know he worked for Eli Lilly. He was in Indiana. He grew up at a children's home, just like these youngsters were at the children's home that I was working for. And so I could sit at dinner with him and cultivate that relationship in ways that I could listen to his stories and hear the stories of the kids that we were serving right then and there.
Exactly. I agree. So you have to find that connecting piece. And for me, one of the things that I do is because the nonprofit I work for is mainly foster care. We have a children's center and some other children's programs is just to really break it down to people and say, everybody's been a child once themselves. So even if you don't have a child that you're raising, or you had a blessed childhood, so you didn't have to grow up in a children's center, but you were always once a child. Yeah. Everybody was. And think about the basic things that you had as a child that made you flourish, not just live, but to thrive. And so with that premise, I'm able to tell people some of the struggles that our kids are experiencing and then put it into perspective for them if they would have experienced those things when they were a child. So example, just recently with Christmas, you know, we were, able to have a very successful toy drive, you know, 1600 kids got at least, you know, 5 presents apiece. That's the warm fuzzies that everybody wants to feel when they donate a toy and they go pick out a Barbie doll for this 10-year-old girl that they picture in their minds. But we had a high impact stakeholder come to us and, you know, say, well, what else do they need? And so I asked the kids at the children's center, and their response was, we want a comfortable bed.
Right.
Like, let, you know, and then you just sit there and you let that sink into that person. That when they were a child, you know, they probably remember the story, you know, the warm feeling of their mother or father tucking them into a comfortable bed. And then you have these children that don't get to experience that. And unfortunately, that kind of takes away the warm fuzzies of the Barbie doll that they gave. But it gets down to the root of it, is that the nonprofits need operating budgets and fundraising dollars to do the unexpected needs of the clients that go above the warm fuzzies of a donor. And I'm able to do that, like we've talked about, because of my 3 years in direct service. And some of those experiences that I've had can really just break it down for that donor and say, you know, this is really what we need. And this is really where you can help and where your dollars will go.
Oh, wow. That's we've had our listeners for a half hour. That's a beautiful place to wrap up. I get it. Yes, that's exactly right. And too much of our fundraising is so based on just getting those trivial gifts that are oftentimes tied to those cute Barbie dolls, which is certainly, we all want a child to have the benefit of a Barbie doll. But at the same time, there's so much, I mean, there's 5 and 10s, and, you know, there's multiple times over more money and much more meaning to give our donors when you have that meaningful conversation, not just with the donor, but you had the meaningful conversation with the children. And the children said, give us a warm bed. I appreciate that you're going to give me a basketball and all this other stuff, but I want to feel comfortable and warm and cared for. You'll raise a whole hell of a lot more money that way than you will with Barbie dolls.
Definitely. It's a very powerful statement coming directly from a child. Kidding.
Well, Ashley, it has certainly been a pleasure to have you on the podcast today. You are always welcome back. I'm looking forward to doing some work in St. Louis at some point together in person. In the meantime, if somebody's listening to our conversation today, they know how to find me, but they want to reach out to you. How would you suggest that they do that?
Yeah, anybody can find me on LinkedIn, Ashley Lambert, and I would be happy to connect. It has been
certainly a pleasure. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.